The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Now let's check ourselves in with Mr. Mike Yardley, writer and broadcaster, historian, a man who has spoken many things about COVID, which many people do not want him to say. And some of the things that have been happening around the media this week have been slightly troubling, but let's find out what's going on with Mike. Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
Hello, Mike. Great to be on the show again. And just as you started this show, Liberty, Liberty Day. It's terrible what's happened to our liberty. This is like an Orwellian misuse of language. Mm. We're not free at all. And the pretense that we're going to have some sort of Freedom Day coming up. I mean, our freedom has been taken away. Our historic liberties, arguably, criminally, possibly against, you know, Magna Carta, against the Bill of Rights, against common law. I think there'd be a very interesting legal case exploring what's happened to us. Now, on my own rather unhappy front,
yes,
having had the blood clot after AstraZeneca, it has amazed me, putting this up on social media, how many people have come and told me they've had the same stuff, very similar stuff. They thanked me for publicizing what's going on. I mean, I looked at the ONS data today, and there's over 1,400 deaths from AstraZeneca and Pfizer together. And an interesting one I found today was that the DVTs that have been reported, so we would expect there would be more, for AstraZeneca are standing at over 1,200. Mm. And lots of people have gone in touch with me and said that they're having incredible difficulty, you know, getting treatment, getting the things sorted out. I mean, I had all sorts of horrible symptoms. I had terrible fatigue. My legs essentially collapsed. I started shedding skin. I had a sort of shingles-like attack. And I'm still far from right, but I'm determined to get better, and I'm determined to help other people in the same situation. I do think that it's amazing that the mainstream media has let down the British public so. I mean, you know, you switch on BBC News and there is hardly any mention of vaccine injury. No. And there are loads of people who've got them. We hear about the odd case of young women or celebrities, young women getting very rare brain blood clots. But there are lots of people getting, you know, fairly ordinary, at least at first sight, DVTs and pulmonary embolisms. And let me just say on that front that although I say that they're ordinary, there does seem to be something different about the COVID vaccine and its effects, and indeed COVID's effects on people's systems, because the sort of blood clots that are being seen begin as micro blood clots. This is not like a conventional blood clot, but the doctors at the moment, if you go along as a victim of AstraZeneca, they will treat you with anticoagulants. They'll probably give you a Doppler scan and then treat you with anticoagulants. But what they're ignoring at the moment, and I've had experience of this myself this morning, they will ignore the broader picture, the systemic picture, possibly the fact that your immune system is reacting in the wrong way to the vaccine. And basically, I was told by my GP this morning that there's nothing, you know, more. He spent a lot of time on this, and there's not really much more that he can do. But I ask him for a referral to another specialist, he'll do that. But this is all very time consuming, and he's got lots of other patients. And I've had many similar messages from people around the country saying they are having the greatest difficulty getting treated. I had to get my MP, Pritian Patel, involved twice. First to see a GP after I failed to get through to the GP, having called the surgery 99 times, which is insane. Mm. And then I couldn't get, having, you know, been given a consultant's appointment, I couldn't actually make that happen without Priti Patel's intervention again. And it did happen, which was great. That was with a hematologist, a blood specialist. And he has now referred me on to a vascular surgeon. And beyond that, I'm hoping I can see someone about what has happened to my immune system. Because as I write to you now, I'm feeling a bit odd. I mean, I'm okay. I'm trying to do everything I can to live a healthy life. But I've got a burning sensation in my legs. I've got burning, like sunburn, on my forearm. It feels like sunburn, stinging in my wrists, stinging in my knees. All of this coming on after the vaccine. Meantime, as you do, you read round the subject. And I'm fascinated to see a lot of people come to me who have specialist expertise. And I had somebody get in touch the other day who was a PCR specialist. And they said, you know, we've been talking about these apps pinging too much and causing people unnecessarily to lose work. But what's also happening is the PCR test that we've got and not being well used in the case of the general public. Now, it all depends on where you set the threshold. And this person was an academic, you know, working in a laboratory and advising officially on this subject. And they were saying, well, it's basically this. If you get COVID, you're infectious for 2 to 4 days. And then usefully, a PCR test can then detect that period of infection, which the serious period lasts about 5 days. The problem is after that, a PCR test may be picking up false positives for up to about 80 days. Now, in the case of testing the general public, no allowance for that is made. In the case of testing NHS staff members, an allowance is made so they can continue working even though they may have tested positive, depending on the other information that they have to hand. So the bottom line of it is this. There are a vast number of cases which are actually false cases, and that is distorting our nation. It's costing us billions of pounds, probably. And it's also giving people completely the wrong idea by how many people who are actually seriously affected in a life-threathening way, or indeed just seriously infected.
Well, I don't know. I don't know, Mike, if you heard my conversation with Richard Tice earlier, but I pointed out to him there was a report this week as well that 40% of the people counted as hospitalised over the COVID variant known as Delta, or the Indian variant as it used to be known, 40% of those people who were in hospital did not go into hospital with COVID. And so, therefore, to count them as people with COVID in hospital is a bit of a cheeky misnomer, isn't it? Because, in fact, they went in with some other ailment, were tested and tested positive for COVID. They probably caught it in the hospital. And we know that. But what I wanted to ask you, Mike, and you've said this before, that one of the problems for you personally was that you had had a blood clot before. Is there any uniformity that you can tell us about in terms of the people who are suffering from DVTs and people who are getting blood clots from it? I mean, is there anything that binds them together, if you like?
Yeah, let me just go back to the point you just made and then go on to that. How many people actually get COVID in hospital? And I asked an academic that question the other day, and they said, well, the data's a little bit confusing, but between 40 and 80% of people who get COVID may actually get it in hospital. So that is extraordinary. Now, as for the what binds people together, I certainly think, I mean, I although I'd had a clot 6 years previously, I was on anticoagulants, and that should have made it virtually impossible to get a clot from the vaccine. Well, as we know, that didn't happen. I did get a blood clot, and many other people got a blood clot. There does seem to be a picture that some people who have a history of things like me, like factor V Leiden, which is a genetic clotting factor, which means your blood clots too easily under some circumstances, that they may have been at greater risk. And they certainly now would have been very poorly advised to have AstraZeneca. There are fewer DVTs reported with Pfizer. According to ONS, there's 172 reported DVTs. That's reported. You'd expect they're probably a lot more. But with AstraZeneca, there are over 1,200 reported DVTs. So that my simple advice would be, if you have any clotting history whatsoever, stay well away from AstraZeneca. And as I've said before, I think it's crazy to vaccinate kids, and that's beginning to come out now. And I think it's crazy to vaccinate young women. But what I want to see, and it's just beginning to happen, is that the story of vaccine injury should be in the mainstream news, because this is affecting thousands of people, and we ought to be talking about it nationally, and we haven't been today.
And it doesn't really make any sense to me as to why, because, you know, you and I have been doing what we've been doing for many, many decades, I dare say. I don't remember a time when I had less confidence in the journalistic fraternity, particularly broadcast journalism, particularly television news at the moment, who are quite willingly and quite obviously taking part in what can only be described as a sort of propaganda exercise. I don't know if you saw, I tweeted out this interview that the ITN health correspondent did with some guy who is apparently being accused of being an actor. I'm not going that far, I don't know. I have asked her to come forward and explain to me what the circumstances were of the interview, how he happened to get into hospital, how he is now doing. But he's being interviewed and basically saying, if only I'd had the jab, I never thought I would get sick, and I would tell everybody else to get the jab. And it's not about how sick he is, it's about him telling everyone else to get vaccinated. I find it very strange.
I find it very strange. And you and I have both worked in newsrooms. I've worked abroad as a correspondent in war as well. We know about the way the news system works, and we know the people in it. I'm amazed that they haven't been doing their job. And I did get one interesting answer back from a correspondent friend, and he said, well, people have mortgages to pay. And it is what we're seeing is propaganda on an unprecedented scale. It's a bit odd because the BBC always used to be rather anti-Tory, rather anti-government. And now they seem to be the Boris's government's poodle in regard to pumping out COVID and vaccine propaganda without qualification, without having a grown-up discussion about it. I'm not anti-vaccination. Vaccination's got a tremendous record of saving life. But I am anti the promiscuous use of these experimental vaccines. I can understand that in an emergency, the government may have decided that, look, we've got no other choice. We need to vaccinate the adult population. And there are risks, but we'll talk about them honestly. Mm. But there's no need to vaccinate children. There's no need to vaccinate young women. There's no need to vaccinate pregnant women.
And there was no, and also, Mike, there was no suggestion that that would ever be proposed as recently as the back end of last year. You know, there was no suggestion that that was going to be what they were going to do. And while, you know, no doubt the government could quite rightly probably say, look, we've vaccinated millions of people. A few of those people have been harmed by the vaccine. But just be honest about it.
Quite. Just be honest about it. And then you have to ask, any sensible person has to ask, is it just about COVID? Is it just about the vaccine? Is there another agenda playing? We hear lots about Mr. Gates and the World Economic Forum and all sorts of conspiracy theories. But I do wonder if there is another element to this, and that is that there is a move towards getting the entire adult population on some sort of digital database. Mm-hmm. And that does concern me. I mean, you know, these are questions that we should be asking, that other journalists should be asking. What is going on? Because this is unprecedented. What's been happening with the BBC coverage and other mainstream TV coverage is nothing less than state propaganda. There is no proper questioning of what's going on. There are many things that have been obviously deliberately left out of the news. And then we have these sometimes almost faked up casualty-like reports from inside hospitals. And as I've mentioned to you before, when I was going in and out of hospitals rather too much than I wanted last year with a very elderly mother, I saw the hospitals were largely empty. It was, you know, what we were being told wasn't the truth. The Nightingale hospitals never used. So we haven't been told the truth. And the idea sort of seems to be this. Well, you watch the news and you believe what you're being told at that moment. You're not meant to be a grown up. You're not meant to have any sense of history, have any memory. You're not meant to use your own powers of discrimination.
And you're not meant to question anything either. We're talking to Mike Yardley, historian, author, of course, as well. Mike, I wanted to ask you about the long COVID clinic that you were sort of sent to. I saw a tweet that you put out earlier in the week. Why on earth would they send you to a long COVID clinic?
Yeah, very interesting. I asked the doctor if he could send me to some specialist, and he said, well, we've only got the long COVID clinic. Right. And I said, well, that probably isn't the right thing. He said, yes, but we've got no long vax clinic.
Right.
So I did have a telephone, a video call with the long COVID clinic, and they seemed to be trying their best. They wanted me to fill out a psychological questionnaire initially. And I said, no, I don't want to do that, because I said, there's nothing wrong with me psychologically. There's something wrong with me physically, right, because I have the AstraZeneca vaccine. And they accepted that. And we moved on. What I thought from my interaction with the long COVID clinic is that they were trying to characterize long COVID as a sort of ME-like disease and sort of file it in that way and get rid of these pesky people who are complaining about it, much in the same way as they're pesky people like me complaining because they're still bloody ill after having the AstraZeneca vaccine, having been advised to have it by their doctors. But going back to what you said earlier, the real thing is, why have journalists stopped being journalists? I mean, you know, we're there to discover truth, to entertain people too, to keep people informed. But certainly the BBC and the other mainstream networks have forgotten their fundamental duty as journalists. Mm. I mean, for example, the death figures, the mortality figures for COVID, which were clearly vastly inflated because these weren't all people who died because of the illness. These were people who died with it and within 28 days of testing. And then the sort of multiple, the mammoths in the living room of things like the Build Back Better campaign, which you see being mouthed by 50 or 100 different politicians all around the world at the same time, that politicians are weaving into their speeches. But who writes the script? Who wrote that Build Back Better script? And why aren't journalists exploring it and talking about it? Because it's pretty weird. I mean, you know, with all the Orwellian and strange stuff that's happening to us, that is perhaps one of the weirdest things. I'm also deeply concerned about the mortality figures, the overall, you know, 130,000 or whatever it is at the moment, mortality figure for COVID, because I'm quite sure that's inaccurate. And I think government policy has been based on inaccurate assessments of, you know, these people who've suffered or died, inaccurate testing. And testing, when I speak to the specialists, it's not necessarily that the tests themselves are bad, it's that they're being used in the wrong way and that the thresholds are being set in the wrong place. So, yes, this is all very worrying stuff, but I just want more people. We're having this conversation. These sort of conversations don't happen very often.
Yeah, but it's not frightening. You know, we're not frightening the horses. Nobody's falling down dead from the shock of the revelations that we're discussing. It's purely and simply another aspect of what is the biggest story that we've been doing for many, many months.
The problem is, by not having conversations like this, you allow government policy to go on unchecked. And for example, let's just fast forward into the future. If the current Tory government creates a sort of dystopian, Orwellian, totalitarian setup, which isn't really tradition of the Tories. But what happens if sometime later a left-wing socialist government takes over, if Mr. Corbyn or someone similar takes over, having had this infrastructure of repression and limitation and, you know, the reduction of liberty created, having had all these new electronic systems and surveillance systems, blah, 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 blah. That is a pretty dark dystopian future we might have to look forward to. So we should be questioning this stuff. Every time somebody tries to take away your liberty, maybe there are circumstances when it has to be done because there's no other way of managing a national emergency. But there should be bloody good reasons for doing it, and they should be discussed.
Absolutely right. And I'll just finish up with this. Lucy Fraser, who's the Solicitor General, was sort of doing the rounds this morning. She was on with James Max. She kept saying, and this slightly troubled me, we're in the middle of a pandemic. And she said it so often that it was clearly a line that she'd been given to trot out. And I did a little quick calculation in my head. And if we are in the middle of a pandemic, that means 15 months hence we'll be out of it, which means that's a year in October, effectively.
Yeah, well, let's get this quite clear. Many people in positions of power at the moment use the word pandemic. There is no pandemic at the moment. By any accepted medical or academic definition, there is not a pandemic on at the moment. You could even have an argument about whether there has been, but there is definitely no pandemic going on now, although many people in positions of authority do continue to use that word promiscuously and wrongly, and giving the public a false impression, and of course making a lot of people fearful. Now, in my old academic background, I was a psychologist. I then went into the army, but I am very concerned about the sort of general psyop that sage experts seem to be organizing and advising on for the government. And it goes beyond that. It's not just sage. The government have deployed what are nothing less than psyops against the British people, many of whom, particularly elderly people, and I've observed this literally because I'm interested in it, are suffering from the effects of that and are showing signs of anxiety and depression and other mental illness as a result of being targeted by government psyops. Now, that really does bother me. That is a real deal, very disturbing. And when people start saying things like pandemic this and pandemic that, they are only increasing the damage and anxiety to those people who at the moment, you still see them shuffling along the road, wearing masks, looking terrified. Those people have been damaged. And people who are using language like that, probably deliberately, to continue making people fearful, to continue people cooperating with what many regard as, you know, a totalitarian agenda, I think that's a really bad thing. Mm.